From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A report by Seymour Hersh in the current edition of The New Yorker says that the Bush administration has shifted its strategy in Iraq and the Middle East, and it's bringing us closer to a confrontation with Iran, widening the conflict between Shiite and Sunni Muslims, and benefiting our enemies in the war on terrorism. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hersh. There are only a few newspapers that still have a stable of foreign correspondents. How the news business is being changed by the emphasis on corporate profits and the growing number of news websites is the subject of tonight's PBS Frontline documentary. We'll talk with Lowell Bergman, correspondent for Frontline's four-part series, News War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Seymour Hersh, has an article in the current edition of The New Yorker in which he reports that the U.S. is coming closer to an open confrontation with Iran. He says this is part of a shift in Bush administration strategy in response to the deteriorating situation in Iraq. A byproduct of this new strategy has been the bolstering of Sunni extremist groups that espouse a militant vision of Islam, are hostile to the U.S., and may be connected to al-Qaeda. Seymour Hersh won a National Magazine Award for Public Interest in 2004 for his New Yorker pieces on intelligence and the Iraq War, and he's the author of the bestseller, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. He broke much of the Abu Ghraib story. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1969 reports on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Seymour Hersh, welcome back to Fresh Air. What is the new strategy that has brought us closer to confrontation with Iran?
It's very simple. We're just, instead of, we're simply going after the Shia. As you know, as many of your audience knows, Iran is a Shia nation. And the President of the United States has decided that we are, these are our enemy, the Shia. We are going to support the Sunnis. And we've basically set up a coalition of Sunni countries in the Middle East. That's, of course, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, along with Israel, the United States, and Great Britain. And the six countries are now in sort of a pack. And it's a pack against Iran. And also, it plays out in very complicated ways in the Middle East. For example, this group is absolutely adamant that the head of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, Nasrallah's in charge of a coalition that's challenging the pro-American government in Lebanon. There's a standoff now. The American joint position with his allies is Nasrallah and Hezbollah, which are Shia, are not to get anything, and that there is to be an absolute no compromise, that the only government that's going to be there is going to be the Sinjora government, which is largely Sunni. And no matter what the cost, even if it means, and we're seeing evidence of this now, we end up with a Sunni-Shia split in Lebanon like we've had in Iraq. So it's a formula designed to put one group in the Middle East, the Sunnis, who are dominant, against the other group, the Shia. And it's just, I don't know whether the White House has totally thought it out, but it's pretty frightening.
At the risk of pointing out the obvious, Saddam Hussein was Sunni. We deposed him. We kicked all the Sunnis out of the military and the police and helped a Shia government get elected in Iraq. And now we're trying to strengthen the Sunnis against the Shia.
Yes, that's the wonderful contradiction of it. Basically, from the very beginning, when the United States and the Bush administration decided right after the fall of the Saddam government, Hussein's government, in April of 2003, we decided then that we weren't going to deal with any of the Sunnis because we dismissed the army, everybody knows that, and we cut the Sunnis, any member of the Ba'ath Party, which is the major political party of Saddam Hussein, mostly Sunni, and we decided we would support the Shia. At that time, I'd say by the summer of 2003, the American intelligence community began telling the White House, you know, the trouble with that is Iran is very close to the Shia government. And the White House did not want to hear that. Because they had concluded that the Shias in the south of Iraq, if you remember, there was a terrible war all during the 1980s between Iraq and Iran, and the assumption was, you know, a war between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and Shia Iran. The assumption was the Shia in Iraq would be more loyal to Iraq than they would be to Iran. You know, because there was a bloodbath between the two of them, a terrible war. And that's one of the great, wonderful contradictions of the whole policy, which makes it very complicated to describe in public because we are totally against the Shia everywhere except for the fact that we're now working with the Shia in Iraq. So you go figure.
Now, you say that this new strategy has brought us closer to confrontation with Iran. There's a special planning group that's been established in the Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff charged with creating a contingency bombing plan for Iran that could be implemented within 24 hours. What is the special planning group? Who's in it?
Well, I don't really know who's in it. I know it's set up inside the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I know it's not supposed to be disclosed to Congress, but most secret groups like that are not supposed to be disclosed to Congress. But basically, the planning for the attack on Iran has been going on. Let me say clearly, contingency planning. There's been no order to attack Iran. And as you know, I've been a Chicken Little, screaming for a year in The New Yorker that the sky is falling, that the planning for Iran is very serious. I think I wrote 4 stories about it last year, or at least 3. Same story. So this has been going on a long time. In the last few months, something new happened. They moved the planning from a joint targeting group, some secret facility in Virginia where they have it. They moved that facility, that part of that planning, directly into the Joint Chiefs. And they authorized, the president wanted a study done so that we can have a bombing attack within 1 day's notice. In other words, the president wanted to wake up one morning and say, today I'm going to do it. At 8 o'clock in the morning, decide to do it, and the bombs will be falling within 24 hours. That's new. The other thing that's new about what he wants, and this is still contingency planning, is that for the traditionally the planning we had been doing, the Air Force and the Joint Services, that is the other army, the other military units in America, the targeting we've been doing was what they call counterproliferation, that is, against Iran's suspected nuclear sites, or the sites that Iran has declared publicly. You know, they're members of the International Atomic Energy Agency Association, and they've declared sites. The planning traditionally was that way. There was also, in the last year, the planning was modified to include regime change, which meant that you then did some planning for what they call in the military, it's a wonderful phrase, decapitation. You're going to go after the leadership, bomb their homes, bomb their offices, and overthrow, you know, basically eliminate the leadership so you'll get a new government. Now, there's a third element in the last month or two. The planning groups have been asked to expand the targeting for terrorism targets. The president has been on a campaign since he gave a speech in early January, January 10th, in which he's been trying to suggest in public, without a hell of a lot of success, I should say, that the Iranians are coming across the border, engaging in Americans who are responsible for killing Americans, which for a lot of people is code word for we then have a right to defend ourselves under the UN Charter, Article 51, we can defend ourselves. It's a code word for that, sort of a just legal justification if we decide to attack. And so he's been talking a great deal about Iranian activity inside, attacking the Americans, et cetera, none of for which there's not an awful lot of proof. And so the planning now has been expanded to include the terrorism sites, I guess training camps and facilities we think that are across the border that are being used as staging areas to attack inside Iraq. The only problem with that, Terry, is it's not clear, and the newspapers are doing a very good job on this. It's not clear that much of this intelligence is valid.
So Iran and Iraq used to be enemies, but now Iran is believed to be supporting the radical
right.
Shiites in Iraq. So that's another reason why the Bush administration may want to bomb Iran.
Well, yes, and also it's more than that. That's always been the condition. That the condition has always been Shia Iran with its threats. The new element is we're now in the last month or month and a half, we have been publicly accusing the Iranians of being very, very active in the war against American soldiers. Mm-hmm. And that means the Shia forces in the south are involved in killing American soldiers when the reality is, and again, what I'm telling you has been reported, is that the overwhelming percentage of deaths of American and injuries to American, 80% or more, come from Sunni insurgents, mostly of them near Baghdad, in a province called Anbar, where there's terrific heavy fighting every day. The overwhelming percentage of casualties, our American casualties, are coming from Sunnis. So what you have is an America that started a war against Iraq, disregarded the Sunnis, began the work with the Shia, and now finding that they can't tolerate the Shia elsewhere in the Middle East. We must stop the Shia from what they call the Shia Crescent. We must stop the Shia from gaining control of the oil, I guess. I don't know what the deep thinking is. We must stop Nasrallah. We must go after the government in Syria.
The Times of London reported that 5 American generals and admirals are willing to resign rather than approve an attack on Iran. What do you know about that?
Well, a year ago I reported that. I don't know anything about that news story. I've seen it. I don't know anything about new people willing to resign. I know a year ago inside the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the staff members, you know, the Joint Chiefs are the 4-star generals that run the military, and they have a joint staff. And the staff does most of the serious planning for the military, the joint operations, you know, all services. And it's sort of the place to be. If you're the best and the brightest, you end up on the joint staff as an analyst or as a planner. And the joint staff was very troubled a year ago because the initial plans that the White House wanted done for the targeting of Iran, this is when all this began, included a nuclear option. And at that time, the Joint Chiefs, there were members of the Joint Chiefs that told the president, the chairman, Peter Pace, the Marine general who's in charge, he informed the White House that there would be resignations if they didn't take that out of the planning. And the White House took it out of the planning last year. So I know that that kind of issue is ongoing, which makes me think that the London Times story is quite credible, although I don't know anything firsthand about it.
My guest is Seymour Hersh. We're talking about his article in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Seymour Hersh, and his new article in the current edition of The New Yorker magazine is about a shift in the Bush administration's strategy in Iraq and the war on terror. And he says that this administration's new policy may be benefiting our enemies in the war on terrorism. One of the conclusions you make in your piece is that because we're trying to now play the Sunni against the Shia, because the Shia are pro-Iranian, is that we are basically strengthening people who are radicals and sympathetic to al-Qaeda. Would you talk about this connection?
Absolutely. One of the more distressing things that I discovered, and I discovered sort of by just being there, I went to Beirut, and among other things, I interviewed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, who's this sort of amazing figure. He was a terrorist 20 years ago. He's now involved very heavily in politics, Hezbollah is. They have members of parliament. They were in the cabinet. They run hospitals, et cetera, church, schools in southern Lebanon. They do a lot for the Shia, the downtrodden Shia. When I went to see him this time, there had been a death threat. He's been under a death threat for a decade from the Israelis, but the security was unbelievable. I went into three or four basements, traded cars, in back seats with everything darkened. I didn't have blindfolds on, but I couldn't see out the windows. There were shields or mat. There was curtains in the cars. And I was put through incredible security. I finally said, what's going on? Are you that afraid of the Israelis? And it turned out, no. What the issue was is there were fellow Arabs. Here's this man who's extremely popular among both Sunni and Shia all over the Middle East for standing up to the Israelis as they did last summer in the war. And he's threatened by Arabs. It turned out both Jordanian intelligence people were looking for him and also Salafis and Wahhabis. That is the radical jihadists who come mostly from ideology out of Saudi Arabia. Basically, the way to describe them is these were the people connected to al-Qaeda that did 9/11, that brought down the two buildings in New York. And it turned out there are three al-Qaeda groups. I shouldn't say al-Qaeda. I should say Salafi jihadist groups with some ties to al-Qaeda. Some of the people had been trained in Afghanistan way back and knew Osama bin Laden, etc. But three of these groups are now in Lebanon, being tolerated, to put it mildly, by the Sinora government, the government we support, the Sunni government. Not only are they being tolerated, they're being given arms, protection. Nobody bothers them. They're allowed to recruit. Why? Because it turns out they're hostile. They're very hostile to America, but they're much more hostile to Shia, to Hezbollah, to Iran. And in case we get into a shoot-'em-up, all-out civil war in Lebanon, which we may, because our policy is for no compromise, that is a Sunni-Shiite war, these are considered to be very good assets in any kind of a war against Hezbollah. They're terrorists who can go and Hezbollah is pretty famous for being a terrorist in its day. They can match each other. So basically, I can't say to you that there's been any overt American direct support for these groups. What happens is we pile a lot of money into Lebanon and other countries. We are working, some of the money is, most of the money, in fact, overwhelmingly, the money is not appropriated by Congress. We are using funds that are illicitly obtained, I shouldn't say illicit, obtained outside of the congressional purview. Funds, I'm told, from Iraq. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia is also supplying money. He's the key player in this Sunni-Shia policy. He's the former ambassador here in from Saudi Arabia to Washington, very close to Dick Cheney, very close to the neoconservatives in the White House. He may be the godfather of this program, I'm not sure, the whole Sunni-Shiite split. But Bonder's putting up money that we're using to run covert operations against the president of Syria and very many operations in Lebanon, including indirectly supplying funds to groups inside Lebanon that support the al-Qaeda.
So let me see if I understand this. The United States is aligned with the Sinhura government in Lebanon, and Sinhura is pro-American, so the United States wants him there. But his power is being threatened by Hezbollah, which wants to change the power-sharing plan in Lebanon, and that would basically end the Sinhura government.
So, which is Sunni.
Right.
It would make the Sunni-Sinhura government less dominant.
Right. Okay. So therefore, the Sinhura government is backing radical Sunni groups to counterbalance the radical Shiite group of Hezbollah, and we're helping him do that. And these radical Sunni groups are our enemy. They're the al-Qaeda connected groups.
One way of looking at it is normally when we learned about a Shia, so these come from the Wahhabi and Salafi religions of Saudi Arabia, fanatical, they're, among other things, the Sunni jihadists believe that those people who are not believers share their values of the religious situation, like Shia, they are expendable. And they believe that they can be killed without any cost at all. This is literally what this Wahhabi and Salafi people believe. That's why they could fly into 9/11 and kill non-Sunnis, Americans and others, without any remorse, because they're infidels. And so normally when we find these groups, we move everything we can to get them out of there, arrest them, seize them. In this case, we are not only looking the other way, there is every reason to believe, my friends in the intelligence community tell me, that there is money flowing into that country. Some of it is ours, a lot of it is Saudi Arabia, money from Saudi Arabia, none of it is appropriated by Congress. Those funds end up flowing through the government of Lebanon, through the Sunni-Sinhura government. They flow into these three al-Qaeda units, or three radical jihadist units, with ties to al-Qaeda. I have to be careful about it. They may not all be al-Qaeda members, but they certainly have ties to it. When I was in Beirut, 3 or so weeks a few months ago, I went back twice. Officials of the Sinhura government, on background, national security officials, senior officials, acknowledge they're there. And they, when I say, why are you letting them be there? And one of them answered to me, and I quote this in the magazine, we're a very sort of open country, and we allow all sorts of people of all different kinds of religion and ideas to be tolerated. That's not true. Before the last year or two, Lebanon was always adamant, and their security people, against the crazies, the jihadists, that didn't want them in the country and drove them out. So it's a total reversal. This is, you could call us, we're now sleeping with the devil, you could say. It's an amazing, it's very complicated, as you can hear.
Can I ask you about what seems to be a contradiction? Vice President Cheney was just in Pakistan saying to President Musharraf, you're not doing enough to combat the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Pakistan and the Pakistan-Afghanistan border area. But Seymour Harris, you're saying at the same time we're letting Lebanon back radical groups that are connected to al-Qaeda.
Because the radical groups would be enemies of Nasrallah and Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. Basically, where Cheney is on this, and this I can say with firsthand information, Cheney's view and the president's view is, we never know what the president thinks, but I can tell you from people who know, who've heard this firsthand, Cheney believes this essentially, that Iran, despite intelligence to the contrary, is going to get a bomb. If they don't have it now, they'll have it soon. And they will use, the agents of delivery will be Hezbollah. He believes Hezbollah, Nasrallah's group, has abilities and facilities inside the United States, that it has undercover units here. And he believes that when Iran gets a bomb, it will give it to Hezbollah, and they will get it blown up in Palo Alto and Shaker Heights and, Washington, D.C. And so he believes that his policy now is not only, this is not about the Middle East or about Western Europe anymore. He's protecting America. He believes he's protecting America. As far as he's concerned, Nasrallah and Hezbollah are the brown shirts. This is, as somebody said to me, it's 1938, and the Germans, the Third Reich, have been given Sudetenland. Some of you people listening will know what I'm talking about, part of Czechoslovakia, and they want more. They're on the border going after the rest of Czechoslovakia. And Cheney has said this, essentially, in front of people I know. And if we had moved then in 1938, maybe we would have had a different World War II. It might not have happened. Certainly it would have been better for Britain. So he sees that as the issue. And that makes, because the enemy is not only Al-Qaeda against the American forces in Afghanistan, it's also Nasrallah. So if you have to sleep, as I say, with the bad guys to get rid of Nasrallah, that's okay. And I think this is, I know this is in the article, Prince Bandar has assured us privately, don't worry about the groups in Lebanon. I know it's unusual for you to be in business with them, but they are much more anti-Shia, much more anti-Hezbollah, much more anti-Iran than they are anti-American. I quote others, including others from Saudi Arabia, as saying, that is totally crazy. The Salafis will go after anybody anytime that they think are don't support their policies.
Seymour Hersh's article on the Bush administration's change in strategy in Iraq and the Middle East is in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Debbie and Norris Bishton, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Seymour Hersh about the possibility of attacking Iran. At a time when international reporting is crucial, only a few newspapers still have a stable of foreign correspondents. We'll talk with Lowell Bergman about how the pressure for profits is affecting the news business. His News War series continues tonight on the PBS Frontline series. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Seymour Hersh, who has been reporting for The New Yorker magazine on covert operations in the Bush administration's war on terror. In the current edition of The New Yorker, Hersh reports that the deteriorating situation in Iraq has led the Bush administration to change its strategy in the Middle East. He says this new strategy is leading us closer to a military confrontation with Iran and is strengthening extremist Sunni Muslim groups who may be connected to Al-Qaeda. You're saying that the Bush administration is doing several things in secret and not telling Congress, at least certainly not in an official way, including making plans to attack Iran and secretly backing radical Sunni groups because Sunni groups who may be aligned with al-Qaeda, because these Sunni groups are seen as a counterbalance to the Shiite country of Iran. So how can this be done without telling Congress?
Well, it can't be. And what I get into in the article is the fact that 2 decades ago we went through this in the Iran-Contra affair, when the Reagan administration wanted to support the Contras against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. Congress said, no, we're not going to give you the money. And they went outside. They sold arms to Iran and used the profits to go do this. And it led to a huge scandal. About a year and a half or 2 years ago, Elliot Abrams, one of the key players in that scandal 20 years ago, who's now the chief assistant to the president on the National Security Council for the Middle East, he convened a group to discuss Iran-Contra, the pros and cons inside the government. And all the old-timers who still worked in the Bush government now came back and they discussed what do you do, how do you do it, lessons learned. And out of this became, obviously, my guess is they had an idea of what they wanted to do. Again, which is using money from the Saudi Arabian government, which was also used back then. The Saudis provided a lot of the funds in the Contra War, using money from the Saudis, using covert money or money that we did not get appropriated from Congress. In any case, we did not go to the various committees of Congress and get authority to do clandestine operations or covert operations against in Lebanon, in Syria, against Iran. They are not cut in the many aspects of this. Perhaps some, there have been some what they call findings. Under the law, the president must write a letter to the Congress saying what he wants. And Congress says yay or nay. They voted up or down, the senior committee members on the Intelligence Committee and the Armed Services, et cetera, and the budget people. And they didn't do this. They've just simply stuck it to the Congress. And this I can tell you, I do know. I don't know if Congress is going to stand up and demand answers. Because they've been very acquiescent, to put it mildly, in the last 6 years.
But, you know, here's the question everybody's wondering. Do we have enough military personnel? Do we have enough tanks and planes and bombs to even tactically pull off an attack against Iran? Putting aside whether it's a smart thing to do or not.
Well, of course we do. We have not tanks. We have no intention of going in on the ground. What we would do is air. And if you remember, right now there's two aircraft carrier groups in that area, one in the Straits of Hormuz. Until 1990, by the way, the Navy never went into the Straits of Hormuz. It's that narrow channel outside of Iran where all the oil ships through from the Middle East into Asia. And carriers never went inside there because it's very hard to maneuver. It's a narrow channel, not very deep. We now have two carrier groups, one there. The plan is for two more to come. I wrote about this. Two more to come this spring. We'll put one in near Oman, one in the North Arabian Sea, and one in the Indian Ocean, and one in the Straits of Hormuz. At that point, are you kidding? We have hundreds of planes, hundreds of missiles. We have cruisers that can deliver cruise missiles. We can put an enormous amount of firepower on Iran. I don't think the plan is to do, there's no ground attack. You just hit them very hard. And what you say to them is, we've hit you hard, we haven't hit everything, unless you give up your nuclear program, we will hit more. And that's the plan right now. That's the basic plan. And whether they do 100 targets or 1,000 targets, these are all being decided. And whether the targets are mostly nuclear targets or whether they're infrastructure targets or whether they're leadership targets or whether they're alleged terrorism targets, that's going to be the new explanation, that Iran is a terrorist state. Yes.
I want to stress here that the Bush administration is saying it is not planning to attack Iran. You obviously have sources who tell you that there are plans in the works, but do you have a sense of what the odds are that those plans will be followed through on and we will actually attack Iran?
Well, no, you'd be crazy to make a prediction about something like that. But I will tell you that the same days, and in response to my story and another story last week in a British newspaper about more advanced planning, they said what you said. That's exactly right. And Dick Cheney didn't get the message. He was in Australia last weekend publicly saying everything's on the table. We're not taking everything off nothing's off the table. So here you have all the press people here in Washington doing damage control, saying there's no planning. And I think by that, of course, there's planning. What they mean is there's no planning beyond contingency planning, in all fairness to them. And the president then just goes and does. The vice president just goes and says what he wants. I can tell you that the senior officers in the Joint Chiefs, the senior men, think it's crazy. Many of them, And so, of course, the Air Force wants to go. The Air Force always wants to go. They always believe in strategic bombing and tactical bombing. But the other services are very, very skeptical. The Navy's very concerned about all those ships they have in the area because the Iranians, among other things, the Republican Guard, National Republican Guard in Iran, owns about 800, as many as perhaps 1,000 little small PT boats or Boston Whalers that can be filled up with they can be turned into suicide boats with explosives. And you suddenly have 500-600 small boats coming at your fleet. You can't stop them. They've done war games on it. They're going to take some serious losses in the Straits of Hormuz if we do start a war. But, you know, nobody knows. And most people don't remember. But the famous vote we made, and the Senate voted the war for Iraq in October of 2002, the one that Mrs. Clinton is having such a hard time explaining away. She voted for the war. The actual words of that resolution authorizing war in Iraq did not limit the president's to only war in Iraq. It said that anywhere he thinks there's a threat, he is given the right to take preemptive action, a preemptive strike. It was an amazing language. Probably the worst single piece of legislation passed in the last decade or two.
Are you saying that he wouldn't have to go to Congress before bombing Iran?
No, the language of that legislation absolutely leaves the door open for any place he thinks there's a threat to the national security of the United States, he can take preemptive action. And it was not limited to Iraq. They didn't even do that in the panic they had at the Congress, the Senate, in the fall of 2002 to fall in line with the president.
Well, Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Great.
Seymour Hersh's article on the Bush administration's change in strategy in Iraq and the Middle East is in the current edition of The New Yorker. Only a few newspapers still have foreign bureaus around the world. Coming up, how economic pressures are changing the news business. We talk with Lowell Bergman about tonight's edition of his PBS Frontline series, News War. This is Fresh Air. Realize that newspapers have done so much cost-cutting that there are now only a few newspapers which have foreign bureaus around the world, including the LA Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today. The emphasis on corporate profits, combined with shrinking newspaper advertising revenues and a growing number of news websites, is changing the news business. That's the subject of tonight's edition of the PBS documentary program Frontline. It's part three of Frontline's four-part series, News War. My guest, Lowell Bergman, is the correspondent for the series. He's reported for The New York Times, was in charge of investigative reporting at ABC News, and spent 14 years as a producer on 60 Minutes. The LA Times has made enormous budget cuts, and some investors think it should eliminate its international news staff. Here's a Frontline clip featuring Charles Bobrinskoy of the investment group Ariel Capital Management, the sixth largest shareholder in the LA Times.
Where the problem is that the people who are writing the LA Times, they want to be writing about international events. They want to be writing long-term pieces about why Bush went to war in Iraq. And we're saying, and the people at the Tribune are saying, there are other people writing those stories. Certainly you would agree with me. There's no lack of coverage on the issue of why Bush went to war in Iraq. Do we really need the LA Times devoting the resources it has to that story? We're saying there's a role for probably three national newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and USA Today. Each has its own niche. All three are national newspapers. We don't think there's any demand for a fourth. The demand is for a very strong, high-quality local newspaper focused on the things that people in LA care about. Style, Hollywood, entertainment, local government, local sports, local issues like immigration. If he was focused on all those issues, there'd be a lot of demand for his product. Instead, he's trying to be the fourth national newspaper.
That's Charles Brobinskoy of an investment group that's one of the major investors in the LA Times. Lowell Bergman, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back again. I was shocked to hear somebody who has such a big investment in the LA Times making an argument against covering the war in Iraq and other international news. But I guess my shock was really naive because that's the direction a lot of newspapers are heading in. Would you explain why he, as a financial backer of the paper, is so opposed to the LA Times continuing to cover international stories?
Well, the model that Wall Street sees as working for newspapers and, for that matter, for many media outlets is local and or what they call hyper-local coverage. They don't see a national advertising marketplace that can support more than a couple, if you will. I mean, in Mr. Brobinskoy's case, he names three newspapers that might be national newspapers, the USA Today, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. They don't see an economic marketplace that will support, for example, a fourth national newspaper. Now his conclusions are those of a group of Wall Street analysts, he being one of them, although he's an investor, but other analysts that we've talked with. The overall question is the economic viability of newspapers, which all media outlets, as well as the public, depend on, and the estimates run to 85% of the new information every day is produced by newspapers, by newspaper reporters. So if news organizations are like television are dependent on newspaper reporters really to guide them to provide insight and in-depth reporting, and they're being threatened, and the LA Times is a good example of that, that's why we followed the Los Angeles Times story, this is raising serious questions for the future of the news in this country.
What questions do you think it raises?
Where are you going to get your news? Who's going to really gather it? Are there going to be professionals out there who are assigned to developing information beyond the handouts that come from, let's say, the government or major institutions or corporations? Will there be people not just jumping into Iraq and coming out with bang-bang footage or stories, but people who are going to look behind what's going on? As Dean Baquet, the now departed editor of the LA Times, pointed out, there really are only three major newspapers in the United States with full-scale bureaus on the ground in Baghdad, in Iraq today. And wire services have people rotating in and out. So the question is, how important is independently gathered, professionally vetted information done by people out in the field with experience, how important that is that to the continuation of the society that we've come to value, democracy as we call it?
Now, getting back to the question of can the LA Times in particular and other newspapers in general afford to cover international news anymore, is the question, do people actually want to read international news, or is the question purely a financial one, that is international news too expensive to be covered anymore?
Well, the surveys vary. Some surveys say that people actually do want international news. That's why they look at their newspaper or they go to the evening news or listen to NPR, for instance, and that there is a huge market for that information. The internet and people at Google will tell you there's a huge market and growing market for that kind of information. The question is the economics of the system as it's been set up. We are now at the point where television network organizations, news organizations, have been cutting back their international news steadily over the last 20 years, closing bureaus, doing less and less hard news. Also because of an economic model that dominated by Wall Street that was calling for more and more profits, so that the news organizations within the networks, which were seen in some ways as loss leaders, they weren't required to produce substantial profits. That's all changed over the last 20 years. As one network executive said to me, the news division is just another production company. So they have closed bureaus, let's say in Rome or in various hotspots around the world, or there's nothing in South America, for instance. It's not covered. Africa, most of Africa. In that kind of situation, newspapers stand out there with their bureaus, with their people spread around the world as the major independent news gatherers for the American public. And now the economic model that it sits on, which is basically printing presses, paper, and trucks delivering newspapers, that model, which costs the average paper somewhere between 60 and 80% of its overall costs, given the internet, that model is no longer viable.
Let's talk a little bit more about why the economic model of the newspaper is in such trouble. I mean, yeah, there's the internet, which is more immediate and so on. But what's changed in terms of the economic base of both, like, subscribers and advertisers?
Well, as the Oracle in Omaha, Warren Buffett, put it, great journalism in America has been living on the back of the price of bananas for the last 50 years. People at one time bought newspapers, not necessarily to read the articles in it, but to look for ads, particularly classified ads. It was a monopoly. Classified ads provided major metropolitan newspapers with just a gush of funds on a regular basis. There was nowhere else to go to get your message out there, to sell your boat, your car, or whatever it was. You had to go to a newspaper. That's no longer true. It's easier to do that in many ways online. And with the phenomenon of Craigslist, which is primarily free, there's no way for a profit-making organization to compete. So that's just one area. So that model is changing rapidly. And as Eric Schmidt of Google says in the documentary, it's one of the unintended consequences of the success of the internet and of Google in particular, along with Craigslist, that it has severely damaged the economic basis of newspapers. And if the irony is, as he agrees and as does the gentleman from Yahoo, that they're dependent on the newspapers for information. So they're sort of killing the supplier. And that has not been sorted out at this point, what to do about all of that.
Now, there was a time when most newspapers were family-owned. The New York Times and the Washington Post still are family-owned. But many newspapers have been bought up by large corporations, by chains, and they're publicly traded on the stock market. And what kind of pressures has that put on newspapers to not only make a big profit, but to keep making bigger profits every year?
Well, even the family, it's really family-controlled, not owned. Most of these newspapers, like the New York Times and the Washington Post, are traded on the stock market. The difference is that the stock that can vote is controlled by the family. So the pressure, they even feel some of that pressure, because if their stock price goes down, they have difficulty borrowing money. They have to pay more money to borrow money to do things and other economic problems. But the bottom line is that the Wall Street has become addicted to short-term profits. So there's a huge amount of pressure on people who work for these publicly traded companies, on the executives, to produce these kinds of profits. At the Los Angeles Times, which got bought by the Tribune Company as part of a giant merger in 2000, those pressures began almost immediately. There were lots of cuts that were made in the printing operation, in the business operation. And eventually, it got into the newsroom at a time when the newsroom had gathered 13 Pulitzer Prizes. That is more Pulitzer Prizes in 5 years than any other newspaper in the United States.
This is the LA Times.
It's the Los Angeles Times. So at the same time that it reached this sort of highest level of journalistic, if you will, achievement, it's being asked to cut its budget. And at the same time, it was making over $200 million in profit on over $1 billion in revenue. So why would this be happening? Because of the demands of Wall Street, because of the fear that over the long term it was going to have a decreasing revenue base, decreasing subscriptions, and be less and less valuable, and the shareholders had great expectations.
My guest is Lowell Bergman, correspondent for the PBS Frontline series News War, which continues tonight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Lowell Bergman, and he's the correspondent for Frontline's four-part series called News Wars. And the next edition is called What's Happening in the News, and it's about how technology and the economics of the media marketplace have affected the news business and changed the very definition of news. In your Frontline documentary, you point to 60 Minutes as the program that proved that news shows could actually be very popular and very lucrative. And that opened the door to thinking, well, shouldn't all the news be making profits then? You worked at 60 Minutes as a producer from 1983 till when?
97, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you saw some of the kind of change that you're talking about, of watching a TV show make profits and change the news shows around it?
Well, I think that 60 Minutes had a unique kind of niche. First of all, understand that it's on at 7 o'clock on Sundays, and that's still a protected time period by the FCC. You have to have family programming, public interest programming. You can't have normal entertainment programming at 7 o'clock on the networks. And the other thing that happened was is that in the late 1970s, there was an exemption given, and it was a union dispute, about allowing not hard news, but what 60 Minutes is considered to be soft news or documentary news, allowing the organization to actually shoot with their own crews on a entertainment, let's say, movie set. And they didn't have to pay everyone on the set, which is what the entertainment side of the broadcasting operation had to do. So therefore, you started to see entertainment profiles on the news. And 60 Minutes was the first to do that. So there, 60 Minutes in that unique situation created a kind of mix of programming with a particular model, and that became, as we say in the documentary, and people know, very, very profitable. Others have tried to reproduce that model and haven't been able to do it over the long term, at least at the level of profitability and audience ratings that 60 Minutes has had. The other networks, with their magazine shows in particular in prime time periods, felt much more pressure to produce higher ratings against competition that in many cases was much more, if you will, lurid or comedic or had other drawing power. And so they started to go down market in order to try to get more ratings. It's understandable, but it wasn't any longer in the era of deregulation anyone holding them back from doing anything. And now you have a situation which I think if you've seen the first 2 hours of the series, if you've seen the legal struggles that have gone on recently between the press and the government over what's the role of the press, for example, in the Scooter Libby trial, a whole battalion of reporters coming in and testifying for the prosecution, for the defense, where reporting information, gathering information, is mixed up with law enforcement and what it's going to do in terms of the court system and prosecutions. And when you have lawyers arguing that reporters should not become an arm of law enforcement, and you turn around and watch on NBC, on NBC News, their highest-rated news program, To Catch a Predator, where the news division is operating basically as a group of vigilantes with law enforcement, enticing people to come into situations where they can be arrested, it makes it very difficult to argue that we have any special privileges and shouldn't be arms of law enforcement. That's one of the more dangerous things, I think, that's developed over the last few years.
You know, the third edition of your Frontline series on the news is all about how the news is changing and how reporters are being let go in television and in newspapers. Foreign bureaus are being dismantled or have already been dismantled at newspapers and TV networks. And, I mean, the ironic thing is all of this is happening at a time when we're fighting this, like, international war against terrorism. And information about the world is so important. And I would just like you to reflect on that paradox.
Well, you know, 9/11, the reaction that the news media had to 9/11, particularly broadcast, to me was a very heartening development because it looked like we were really going to see a resurgence in real reporting. And I got involved, heavily involved, both in coverage for the New York Times but also for Frontline. We did a whole series of documentaries. And I remember in part of promoting that, I was on Larry King's show, and in the break, Larry King leaned over to me and he said, you know, this is great. I don't have to do Gary Condit anymore. And the fact is he has to do it again. And I was one of those optimists after 9/11 thinking that that tragedy, that catastrophe, seemed to maybe change the news business, particularly the television news business, that people began to understand that you needed to know more about the world. You needed to know what a Wahhab was in Saudi Arabia. You needed to know what the history was of the Middle East in order to understand why we were attacked. And, you know, within 6 months, however, whatever those lessons were that we thought we had learned, and my optimism disappeared. And unfortunately, we may have to go through another catastrophe for people to understand that the population needs real information to make rational decisions. And in a period where you're talking in a period of semi-permanent war, according to the administration, you need real information more than ever, because the first casualty in any war is the truth. And that's not just a saying.
Lowell Bergman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lowell Bergman is the correspondent for the PBS Frontline series News War. Tonight's edition is called What's Happening to the News? Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at tiaacref.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Just over a year ago, ABC News anchor Bob Woodruff was nearly killed by a roadside bomb in Iraq. He suffered a severe brain injury and was in a coma for over a month. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Woodruff and his wife, Lee, about his injury and the process of recovery. They've written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.